My next guest, Damon Tabor, went deep inside the shadowy international ivory trade, now a $10 billion business annually, to speak with the poachers, middlemen, carvers, and consumers driving the industrial-scale slaughter of African elephants. His investigation is called The Ivory Highway. It appears in the March issue of Men's Journal magazine. And I'm very pleased to welcome Damon Tabor to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This week, the Obama administration announced new restrictions on animal trafficking, including regulations which seek to completely prohibit the sale of ivory in the United States. Will these new regulations make much of a difference, do you think?
I think they will. I think there are, in the conservation community right now, there's a lot of good feeling about these rules and regulations.
And other countries have also been crushing ivory, China, France.
Correct.
So in destroying the ivory, we are somehow destroying the trade?
I think that's not entirely the case. I think the idea with destroying the ivory, which the United States also did several months ago, is it's more of a symbolic gesture. And I think what conservationists have been saying for a long time is that in addition to that kind of symbolic gesture, we also need to start enforcing the laws about the global trade in ivory.
I call the trade shadowy. Is it also dangerous to investigate?
You know, there were certainly parts of this investigation that were a little bit harrowing. But, you know, one of the surprising things that I learned along the way is that a lot of the people that are involved in the trade, at least at the on, you know, the Africa side, who are actually pulling the trigger and killing the elephants, you know, to a great extent, these are people who are just trying to make a living. And they're making, I think, a rational economic decision that a lot of people in their shoes would probably make.
Similar to the people who grow poppy in Afghanistan because it's the only subsistence crop they have available to them.
Absolutely correct. I mean, if you could go into the jungle and you could get a piece of ivory from an elephant and you could sell it for several hundred dollars, which is more than you would make in a year, and you could pay for your family to eat for that year and put your children through school, I think there probably are a lot of people who would do the same.
Do we know how many elephants have been killed in the past few years?
We have a really we have rough guesses, and CITES, which is the organization, it's the World Treaty Body, which sort of governs the wildlife trade, put out numbers in 2013. They said 23,000 elephants were killed, I believe, in this previous year. I should say, though, that a lot of conservationists, and myself included, from the research I've done, think that number is absurdly low, and the actual number is much higher, probably closer to 50,000.
And is it escalating?
It is. It is. It's not getting better. And I think at this point we are in a race against the clock.
Elephants faced with extinction?
It's a possibility. Some conservationists, some prominent ones, have raised that that likelihood in 10, 15, 20 years at the current rate of poaching. That's a possibility.
Now, much of the trade winds up in Asia. There are elephants in Asia. Why is Africa where the tusks are gathered?
I think there are a few reasons. One, there are numbers, number one. In Asia, there are far fewer. Africa has the great herds. I think there's right now there are about 420,000.
At 50,000 a year, that could disappear very quickly.
It's dwindling rapidly. I mean, what's scary about that is the rate of poaching has currently outpaced elephants' ability to reproduce for their populations. And so, if that trend continues, that's when you begin to get worried about it.
You began your investigation in Cameroon, speaking with a poacher named Pierre. How do most poachers get involved in the ivory trade, just as you suggested, because they're desperate and that's the only way they can make a living?
I think that's the case often. I don't want to put too pretty a face on the poaching trade, because I think there are certainly people who become involved for opportunistic reasons and simply to make money. Justin, which is another character in the story, I think he was an example of that. But for Pierre and people like him, again, it's a rational economic decision. It's a good way to make a lot of money very quickly.
Well, I'm assuming that the expeditions to kill the elephants would need some logistical support. Mm-hmm. Who finances them?
That's absolutely correct. I think in a lot of cases, particularly in Cameroon and the rest of Central Africa, what you tend to see are people funding these expeditions who are in positions of power, either government officials, military officials.
You mean local government officials? Or
correct.
Outside.
Correct. People who have the money and the means to to fund an expedition that can last 2 to 3 weeks in the jungle and requires buying guns, requires buying bullets, requires buying food and paying, you know, people to carry all those things. And your average poacher doesn't have the financial means to do that.
Once an elephant has been killed, how are the tusks removed?
Well, it's a pretty grisly process. There are Pierre. I asked Pierre about that, and what he told me is that he had a special machete that he used, and you have to basically cut around the elephant's skull.
And then leave the elephant to rot?
And then in many cases, the rest of the elephant is just left to rot.
So we're killing a whole animal because we want a little portion of it.
That's correct.
How much is a single elephant worth to a poacher?
An elephant tusk, when I was in Vietnam reporting the story, a single tusk could fetch about $50,000 or $60,000 U.S.
Wow,
and that's at the final end of the ivory trade. And so the money, you know, what a poacher would be paid for his work in the jungle is significantly less than that, probably a few $100 at most.
Well, we're talking about a $10 billion a year business. How does that compare with the drug trade or illegal arms?
One recent study ranked it fourth behind the drug trade and arms and human trafficking. And that's not just ivory, though. That's including all wildlife trafficking in the world.
Because we're talking about rhino tusks as well.
Absolutely. And they're in an equally dire position as elephants.
And are the males being targeted because they have bigger tusks?
I think that at this point, and this is a sobering point, poachers decades past used to kill only males because they grew the largest tusks. But now we're at the point where ivory fetches such a high price that poachers are willing to kill not just female elephants, but also young calves who grow, whose tusks are just several inches long.
My guest is Damon Tabor, whose article, The Ivory Highway, is in the March issue of Men's Health magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So they now would go after entire herds of elephants. In some cases, they just mow them down with assault rifles, landmines.
Correct. Grenade launchers. What's really dramatically changed in the past few decades is in the 70s and around that era when the last time we faced a great poaching wave, you know, poachers, it was often subsistence hunters killing one or two elephants at a time. And what you see now is like what happened in Cameroon in 2012, which was a group of 50 to 100 armed horseback poachers who were able to cross into the country with relative impunity and kill at will for several months, and they ended up killing 400 elephants.
You even describe an incident where poachers lace salt licks with cyanide.
They did. That one was, I think, particularly diabolical because it killed, I believe at last count, maybe 100 elephants. But not only the elephants, any animal was sort of collateral damage that either fed from the elephant's carcass or drank from nearby water sources.
Now, in Africa, there have been a number of civil wars that have been paid for by gems. Mm-hmm. Is the same thing happening here, or rebel groups like Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army and Al-Shabaab, mm-hmm. are they engaging in this trade?
There is very strong evidence. It's largely circumstantial at this point, but there is very strong evidence, I think, pointing to the involvement of the groups that you just mentioned, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, which lately became infamous for the attack on the mall in Nairobi, and Joseph Kony's group as well. And I think that the evidence is pretty strong at this point. And so that means that you have to begin considering the prospect of an armed group trading in ivory and then using that money to fund an attack such as the one in Nairobi.
How are the elephant tusks smuggled out of the wild and then out of a country? Some of them are quite large.
Some are indeed quite large. I think the trafficking methods vary. The middleman dealer that I interviewed, Justin, he sort of had this ingenious setup where he would pay pygmy poachers who were in the jungle to hunt the elephants for him. And the pygmies have been sort of long known as these legendary elephant hunters and trackers. And so, he outsourced essentially the dirty work of killing to them. And then he would collect the tusks from them, and then he would put them in the back of his car, I think, and then he would drive them, essentially doing this midnight run, from the remote southeast of Cameroon to the port on you know the Northeast, and then he had a customs guy there who would he would pay off, and then the customs guy would put the ivory in a cargo container, and then it would be sent to China.
You note that there were large syndicates aiding the trafficking. So the customs guy probably isn't the only person who's being paid off.
That's absolutely correct. I think the corruption is endemic, not just on the Africa side, but as Asia as well.
In one town, you say a Catholic priest acts as the ivory middleman.
Mm-hmm. This is correct.
Have governments in Central Africa taken any action against the elephant poaching? Because elephants also are a source of tourists. Income mm-hmm. aren't they?
Mm-hmm. They are indeed. Kenya especially has been, I think, at the forefront of really taking a sort of active approach to combating poachers. Conservationists call that conservation at gunpoint, essentially. And at this point, I think a lot of people agree that it's not going to be enough to stop the poaching trade. You also have to do something on the demand side, which is primarily, when you say that, China and, to a lesser extent, Thailand.
So it's being sent to parts of Asia. What has driven the spike in Chinese demand for ivory recently?
I mean, it's I think primarily a phenomenon of China's rising middle class. There is now an ascendant middle class that has disposable income, much like the United States did several decades ago, and can now afford to buy these things. And ivory in Chinese culture has really been a status symbol for a long, long time. But the problem was nobody could afford it until recently, and so now you have really a large and rising middle class that you can, and they are.
Now, they're buying carved items out of ivory, or are they grinding it into a powder and eating it as an aphrodisiac? I've heard
right.
some people do that.
The powder is rhino horn, and that's primarily that is China, but happening elsewhere as well, Vietnam. And
somebody suggested giving those people Viagra to save the rhinoceros.
I don't think it's not a bad solution. But with the with respect to the ivory tusks, for the most part, people I think in China are buying either these really elaborate and I almost hate to say it, but they're sort of beautifully carved sculptures, and also trinkets, jewelry.
Well, you note that China is just the latest in a long line of ivory obsessed nations, going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, and we had Americans in the 19th century. For a long time, pianos actually had ivory keys. What is the appeal of ivory?
For the Chinese, I think it's, this is something that has long been part of their cultural heritage going back, I believe, millennia.
And you describe the Chinese market as a black box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's in several ways. One, it's a black box in that it was incredibly difficult to report what was happening, largely because the Chinese government has been resistant to releasing figures and to dealing with journalists like me who show up on their shore and want to sort of pry open the box.
Mm-hmm. Well, China does maintain a legal ivory market, so that complicates the matter?
They do. It complicates the matter immensely, and a lot of conservationists believe that is sort of the single greatest factor that is driving Chinese demand, or it's the largest contributor. And what happened is, in 1989, when we were facing the last great poaching wave, the world's nations gathered together under CITES, and they agreed basically to allow to pass a prohibition against the global trade in ivory. And that happened. And so that meant that you could not trade in ivory across international borders. But many countries, the United States and China included, were given sort of dispensations, and they were allowed to maintain domestic markets. And so China has maintained a domestic market for a long time in ivory. And what happened was in 2007, they bought a significant quantity of stockpiled African ivory from several countries in South Africa. I think it was 70 tons, something like that. In order to do that, they agreed to create a system of regulation and control. And now conservationists, there's a lot of intricate details to it, but conservationists are now saying, and my own experience bore this out, is that regulatory mechanism has failed.
You traveled to Beijing, which is the world's largest ivory market, and talked to some ivory dealers and consumers, and you report that they engage in a fair amount of rationalizing over what they do.
I do. I think the people who are involved in the trade, which is to say the dealers and the middlemen on the Asia side, I think there's a fair amount of self-delusion maybe that's happening. But then for the consumer, the average consumer, there are a lot of misconceptions about where the ivory comes from. In China, that means there's a widespread belief that the ivory just falls from the elephant's mouth sort of naturally, like as if it were milk teeth. There is this animal does not meet a very gruesome end in order for you to buy
it's easy enough to inform people otherwise. A listener, Andrea from Brooklyn, wonders why they can't just put the elephants to sleep and cut the tusks off and let them live.
I think that is. I've heard that question before, and I know they're trying that with rhinos. I think
not that that's any something that I would recommend, but
no, it's a legitimate question, and I've seen it before. I think one of the main problems with that is that tusks are a very utilitarian tool for the elephant, which is to say they use them constantly. They use them to feed, to forage, to find water, to render assistance, and so if you suddenly put that animal into the wild without its main tool, I don't think it would survive for very long.
You note that many Chinese were reluctant to speak with journalists about the ivory trade, but you did speak to a man who asked to be identified as Mr. He. What makes ivory desirable to him and to other collectors?
We were talking about before, he was a really fascinating character in a lot of ways. I think he captured sort of the dilemma that conservationists are facing. He was newly he was an artist. He was a documentary filmmaker. And, he was, by the standard of China, I think China's middle class, relatively affluent. And so he could afford to buy ivory. And he did. And he had a significant collection of ivory that he was buying. And he was also well-educated enough to know where it was coming from. He knew the damage that he was doing. But when I asked him, knowing with that knowledge in mind, do you plan on stopping? He said, I don't know that I can.
Well, there are a lot of people who are upset about killing dolphins because we recognize – and whales because we recognize that they are rather intelligent, not that that should be the only reason you shouldn't kill an animal in the wild. But elephants are also extremely intelligent and have been shown to be empathetic. Do scientists have any sense of how the elephants are reacting to this? They must recognize now that they are in danger.
They do. I think and you see that in a number of ways. I mean, elephants are really fascinating characters, I should say. And I should – I really – in the story, I really tried to make them a character as much as I could, because I think a lot of people have become inured to the story of ivory poaching. And if you hear this number, 50,000 elephants killed, that doesn't really resonate so much if you understand these animals and sort of how fascinating they are. They're highly complex. They're not a lot of the science is new, but also pointing, I think, to the fact that they're not much different than we are. I mean, they have this capacity for high emotional intelligence. The brains are complex like our own. The Bronx Zoo, recently did a study called the Mirror Test, where they put a mirror in front of an elephant named Happy, and they painted an X, I believe, on her forehead, and Happy was able to look in the mirror and then touch her own face with her trunk. And what that means is that elephants have a capacity for self-awareness, which is not different, than us.
Well, to some degree, it's almost like killing people because you want the back molars.
Right.
You met with a former Israeli intelligence officer who was leading the effort against ivory trafficking. How successful has he been?
I think for one man operating on a shoestring budget and with a small staff of volunteers, he's been amazingly successful.
What are his
successful
tactics?
His name is Ophir Drouri, and he runs a group called Laga, which is the last of the great apes. And he's a fascinating guy. He was a former Israeli intelligence officer, and then he came to Cameroon, and he's just, a great, great animal lover. And so he became involved in this trade, and what he does he sort of fights on two fronts. One is he does undercover investigations and stings, where he'll go into the field or send his operatives into the field, and what they do is set up deals with ivory buyers, and then they bring the police along with them. And that often works. The problem is, in a country like Cameroon and in many other countries in Africa, corruption is so endemic that even if you catch the poacher or the trader red-handed and he's got the ivory tusks in his hand, that guy will be very quick. Will buy his way out of the back of the police car or the jail. And so also the other thing that Ophir is doing is beginning to tackle that corruption and go after the people with who I think really enable this trade in ivory.
Well, you said that people are inured to the problem. Mm-hmm. So how do we educate the public to the fact that this is really an awful thing to be doing, and that we may very well, for tusks, be making elephants extinct in the near future?
I think it's beginning to happen now. I mean, I think you're starting to see these public awareness campaigns. I saw several in China, and I think that is going to be hopefully begin to change consumer demand in Asia. Which is to say, just essentially connecting the dots, showing people that what happens, when they buy this this bracelet or this statue, that it actually comes from a living animal several thousand miles away.
My guest has been Damon Tabor, whose article in the March, the current issue of Men's Journal, is The Ivory Highway, or on the cover it says Inside the Ivory Trade, the Global Black Market That's Driving Elephants to Extinction. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org, although you could just as easily go out there and get a copy of Men's Journal. And Damon, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.